Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 7 years of law enforcement analysis experience. She's currently the president of the Virginia Crime Analysis Network, also known as VCAN. She has crime analysis experience with both Arlington County Police Department and Fairfax County Police Department. Representing the great state of Virginia, please welcome Sarah Totten. Sarah, how are we doing?
Thank you, Jason. I'm doing good over here. How about yourself?
I am doing very well. So before we get started, I hope you say yes to this question. I noticed that you spell your name Sarah with an H.
I do.
Are you secretly catty against other people that don't spell Sarah with an H?
You know, it's funny. I wouldn't even say it's secret. I very much have the gripe of the Sarah with and without an H. And I will say that there's a lot of times, like I'll go to Starbucks or something, and they do take the extra step of asking me if it's with or without an H. And it just warms my heart so much because I think it's totally well known out there. Like, hey, us Sarahs, we're really loyal to how we spell it. So yeah, you're totally right.
If I polled a bunch of friends, I wonder how many would spell it with an H versus not an H.
It's pretty 50-50, I've come to find. And I have yet to meet a Sarah that spells it however their God-given name is and wants to change it to the other way. Like, we're pretty dug into our camps.
That's true. That is funny. I am so glad you said yes to that question. Well, let's just talk about how you discovered the law enforcement analysis profession.
Sure. So it's been kind of a little bit of a lifelong journey for me. I started out, even going back really to childhood, my parents met at work. My mom was a probation officer and my dad was a public defender. So I come from parents who were in the criminal justice system and they both had a passion for it. And, you know, growing up in that household, I just really kind of soaked it in. And I just thought that was also super fascinating. So I went to college and I wasn't necessarily thinking I was going to follow that path. I thought I was really more interested in English and teaching, but the more that I was in college and just taking different classes, I really found myself gravitating back to criminal law. I just found it so fascinating. I would love to just like read about cases, and I started taking classes in it to the point that I added another major of criminology just because I just was so fascinated with it. So I thought that was going to manifest into perhaps becoming a prosecutor because I really had a heart and a passion for criminal law and, you know, getting the bad guys, which my dad loves to give me a hard time about because he is the other side and he always tells me that I am a traitor in all good fun. I really thought that was going to be my route. So I went to college at JMU, James Madison University. It's in Virginia. It's central in the state. I decided after I graduated, I was going to move to Northern Virginia. I'm originally from New Jersey. I didn't think I wanted to go back there. I thought I kind of wanted to go more towards DC. And, you know, kind of that's the central hub of a lot of, you know, criminal law entities, and just kind of find my way there. So I moved to Northern Virginia and I got a job in the Commonwealth Attorney's Office, which Virginia is one of four Commonwealth, for those who don't know. So some people call their prosecutors district attorneys. Virginia, we call them our Commonwealth attorneys. So I got a job in the Commonwealth Attorney's Office. I was doing just some admin work, but I thought that was going to be my way in. I was going to get to see kind of how they do what they do. I had this whole plan. I was going to work there while I went to law school. And then I was just going to roll right in and, you know, maybe start being a prosecutor there. I had this whole plan. So, and the prosecutors there were wonderful to me. But they also were very well aware of my plans because I would sit and on my lunch breaks, I would study for the LSATs. And so many of them sat me down and they were like, are you sure this is the route you want to take? And, you know, they really had me kind of second guessing it, because a lot of them were like, look, this has been a lot for us. We don't get paid that much. It's a lot of hours. Just like, make sure this is really what you want to do. And that really, you know, gave me some pause. So I still took the LSAT, and I was very much like, I was about to put my deposit down to go to George Mason, which is a law school that's in Arlington. And at the time I was living in Arlington, so I was very close by. I had this whole plan, I was going to walk there and everything. And I really just kind of had this moment of like, this might not be the route for me, but I feel a little lost now, because I know that this is the realm and the field that I'm interested in. It just might not be in, you know, prosecuting criminal law. So I was doing a lot of research about maybe where I could go back to school still, because I'm a big old nerd and I love school. So I thought maybe I would be going back to school for something, doing something like that. I just was happening to look at the job boards. I just stumbled on a crime analyst position that was opening up at the Fairfax County Police Department. And I knew a few of the officers from working in the office. So, you know, I chatted with a few of them to kind of get a sense of what it was, because the job description itself, I was like, this sounds great. This sounds very similar to what I'm interested in. And maybe this is the path. So I talked to a few of them and they were like, yeah, you know, it sounds like what you're interested in, you should go for it. And I was, you know, I was lucky enough to have done well on the interview and practical, and I got in that way. So I spent a few years with Fairfax, and then I hopped on over to Arlington, and here I've been since.
All right. Interesting. Couple of follow-up questions then. So you mentioned that you came in to college studying English. Do you consider yourself part of the grammar police?
So sometimes I definitely find myself being that person, and I apologize to anyone who's been in my warpath, but I have also in my multitasking, because I love to do too many things at once, see that I violate the very rules that I can be a stickler about. So I try not to be too harsh about it, because I can sometimes miss my own mistakes.
And then interesting about the LSAT and going on to law school, because similar path for me. I was leaving undergrad and thinking about law school, and took the LSAT, and I interned with a local attorney at the end of my senior year in undergrad. And just, I think it would probably, we came to the similar conclusion. I didn't have necessarily folks trying to talk me out of it, but I just was what I was experiencing an internship, what I was reading about, doing my research, I decided it wasn't the right path for me. And I did something that most college advisors would not suggest you do. I went to school until I found a job. So I got a computer certification, I got a master's degree, and it was at the end of the master's degree that I found a job. It's interesting hearing you say that, because I think we have similar paths in studying that. So what did you think of the LSAT?
Oh, it was horrible. that was a horrible test. I remember, because it still haunts me, the logic games section, which for those who have taken the LSAT, I think they would be fun if there was no time constraint on those. But you need to figure out this pattern to this very complex question in about 60 seconds. And sometimes it just takes you 60 seconds to just wrap your brain around what they're asking you. So those just really haunted me.
Man, the one that haunted me was the essay. Because I did it by paper, and it's showing probably how old I am. It's probably all computer now, but they did it on paper, and it was on carbon paper. So they basically told you, don't erase.
Oh man.
And right now,
that's nerve-wracking.
So you're just writing through there. And I write this sentence at the end that just, oh man, it was basically, you had to make an argument for or against something. And I basically concluded in the paragraph that this was better than doing nothing, which was awful the way to end that essay. And I don't know why I wrote it that way, but I was literally stuck with it. I tried to cross it out. It was a mess, but yeah. I can't remember even the scoring system there. I mean, I did about average. It wasn't like I lit the world on fire with my LSAT scores.
Yeah. Oh, same here. I actually left the LSAT and I called my mom crying. So I was like, that test was so hard. So yeah, it is not for the faint of heart for sure.
Okay. So then you go through the Fairfax crime analysis interview process. And you mentioned not only an interview, but a test involved with that as well.
Yeah. So they had, that was like a two-part interview process. So I remember I came in and I had, I believe it was about a 45-minute practical. I was given, I believe, a scenario about, you know, like I had like a community outreach meeting and this is the crime that's going on. And I was given some graphs and some numbers and basically, you know, how would I put this together to be helpful for the meeting? And then I think I was also given some Excel questions and problems to work through as well, mm-hmm. just to kind of gauge what my base level skill sets were.
Was that something done outside or was that something you did at the police department and you only had a certain amount of time to do?
That was done at the police department. Yeah. And I was given a time limit and it was, I believe right after that, I rolled right into the interview panel process itself.
Okay. We had a pretty big discussion at the IACA conference this year. And I was part of a internship panel that I emceed. And so we got talking about hiring and the whole hiring process there. And it's fascinating to me because there's a lot of restrictions that different agencies have. For instance, we were talking, one agency says at the interview, they can't even look at a resume. So if you, as an interviewee, roll in with a resume, they can't look at it.
That's
by policy. And so some of the stuff is really restrictive in terms of this whole process. Here you have there in Fairfax, a system in place in which not only are you given an interview, but a very specific crime analysis task to complete.
Yeah, I believe I knew there was going to be a practical beforehand, which was helpful because I could kind of mentally prepare for what that might be. But I have heard of similar instances that you're kind of referring to. I've never heard of a department not being allowed to look at a resume or any materials brought, but I've heard some places they don't do practicals at all. I've heard that they do several step interviews. So it's pretty diverse across the board, kind of what the process is.
And then the interview was a panel interview?
Yep, it was a panel interview. It was at the time the director of the unit, and then two analysts.
Now, was this just one position, or were they hiring a few analysts?
I believe it was just one position at that time. I think they had just hired another analyst for another vacancy a few months before me. So that person was in background, and then I was kind of completing the unit. I think I was the last vacancy at that time.
So you beat out everybody.
I was lucky.
Just reminds me, we should do a reality show like Survivor, except it's crime analysis and you have to work through several crime analysis stuff to, you know, each week we get another candidate gets voted off the island, so to speak.
That'd be grueling, but yeah. Probably good TV.
All right. So you show up for your first couple of days there at Fairfax and just take me back. What were some things that you think of now and maybe laugh at or roadblocks that you were able to work around as you look back at your first couple of days as a crime analyst?
Yeah, that's so funny going back in time. So what was very interesting, and I'm not quite sure that they do it this way anymore, but for Fairfax, because they are a larger agency, and by a larger agency, their crime analysis unit has between like 10 and 15 analysts, which for our region is on the larger side. They have kind of a more established training process. So when I first started, I did not even go and sit where my desk was. So to give a little context, Fairfax, there, even though there is a crime analysis unit, everyone is assigned to a particular location. And there's either station analysts, which there's 8 stations and 1 analyst per station. And then there's a few specialty positions. There's 2 analysts that are in major crimes. One is assigned to traffic. One is assigned to narcotics, et cetera. So I was hired as a station analyst. But for my first, I believe it was 2.5 months, I didn't even go and sit or even meet the folks that were at my station. I worked up at headquarters and just learned how to be an analyst there without getting inundated with, you know, requests and you know, just the bombardment of, you know, being at your location. I give my boss at the time credit. It just kind of sheltered me from getting thrown into the deep end and, you know, really helped me immerse myself into this field and, you know, what it's all about, what am I going to be doing, and taking on those tasks kind of offline in a sense before getting thrown into, you know, dealing with detectives and officers who are not going to be forgiving of this new person. It's just kind of getting her feet wet and things.
Yeah. Who were your manager?
So Angelique, she actually works down in Boca Raton, Florida now.
Oh, okay.
I'm blanking on her last name. Angelique Pickett. She's wonderful. And she is a supervisor, I believe, down in Boca Raton, Florida now. And she was great and just helping me figure out how to be to be an analyst. And then I had 2 mentors who are still really mentors to me to this day at Fairfax as well, who absolutely I credit for the analyst that I am. Jessica LeBlanc, she's now switched over to the fire side of things, but she still is very, very knowledgeable in the data analysis. And Jennifer Harrington, formerly Jennifer Godown, has very much been instrumental in me being the analyst that I am today. So I'm very, very blessed and fortunate that I had them helping me learn this field.
That's an interesting process in itself there. I like that 2 months on the job training that,
yes,
that you went through. So what did you find particularly difficult?
I think just figuring out what was going to be the expectation of me, because it was very clear that, like, hey, this is kind of a jack of all trades kind of gig. You're there's not going to be one specific thing you're doing or one specific person you're helping. It's really going to be meeting the needs of everybody as it comes. And the particular station that I was assigned to, which was Mount Vernon, had probably the highest concentration of crime of all of the stations in the districts in Fairfax. And they have a heavier concentration of gang crime. So they were just kind of known for being a busier station and focusing more on that side of things. So I was excited about that because I thought the work was going to be very interesting. But I was a little nervous as to what that was going to mean, what was going to be expected of me, how involved was I going to be in investigations, was I going to be embraced because I'm just this new person coming in. There's always the fear. There's no other analysts there, so there's really no one to, like, kind of help me you know, make my entrance. I kind of just got to figure it out myself. So those were the kind of the nerve-wracking things that I had to work through.
So then you get stationed, you finish your 2 months. You decide to, this is what you want to do with your life. So once you got to the office, did the training match reality? It's because I know there's times where people will say, well, headquarters does it this way, but here we do it this way.
I wouldn't even say headquarters really taught me one specific way. Mm-hmm. I kind of traveled around to other analysts' spots to kind of see what they do and how they do their particular jobs. So I wasn't given really a, like, hard and fast, like, this is how you're going to do things. It was just more like, you know, here's overall what we do here. Here's how everyone else does their job. Hopefully these are the tools you can use to figure out how you're going to do crime analysis down in Mount Vernon. We're here as a resource. Now we're going to let you fly, baby bird. So that was very helpful because once I got down there, I still had other analysts to kind of bounce ideas off of. And I remember there was the one instance that kind of gave me the vote of confidence and also the like, oh yeah, I'm into this kind of work was there was this particular suspect, and I'm not quite sure, I don't remember what exactly he did, but I remember one of the detectives came into my office and asked me to figure out who he was. And they only had, I think, a photo and whatever his handle was for some like obscure social media website. I think they got it from the victim, and they wanted me to kind of help out, figure out who he was. And I just had a ball, you know, digging into, you know, who this person could be, looking through all my different, you know, law enforcement databases and like social media, open source. And I kind of laid out this whole process of how I came to who it probably was. And I made a bulletin for him. And I sent it along to my detective and a few of the analysts that were helping me out. And they wrote back and they were like, oh yeah, no, this is good. This is you're approaching this the right way. And it just, it lit me up and I was like, oh, this is fun. I'm into this.
Nice. Get that early win.
Yes.
So is that the type of tasks you were in? Because I know they do CompStat. Were you doing some of the bean counting and the reporting as well, mixed in with some of the intel casework?
Yeah, I was primarily helping out more with investigations, but definitely as a station analyst, there was wearing all of the hats. So CompStat at the station levels, because that's how it was held at the time, was primarily, there was some numbers, but really it was based more so on the weekly report that I would produce. And all of the detectives and then the supervisors of the various shifts and our captain and lieutenant, we would come in once a week and we would just review it. And everyone would kind of talk about where they were at, what's patrol doing to handle it, where's the investigative process at. And that was kind of more used as our weekly touching base, less and less so our, hey, what's our projections and how are we going to strategically do things from here on out kind of thing. I did definitely help out with numbers with my commanders when they needed it. But just given the nature of that particular station and what they focused on, it was really more an investigative side of things.
So then, as we mentioned already, you move on to Arlington County. That's just a neighboring county. So was that like leaving for your rival? Is there competition down there amongst the counties in Virginia?
So Fairfax, to give a little context for those who don't know this area, Northern Virginia, a large portion of it is Fairfax County, and many of the surrounding jurisdiction and counties are much smaller. And that is reflective in the analysis units. Fairfax has, as I said before, like 10 to 12 analysts. The rest of us have 1 to 2. Some have a little bit more than that. So there's not necessarily a rivalry with the analysis units or anything like that. I would say it's the contrary. We actually all work very well with one another and share information with one another very freely. But I would say Fairfax 10, because it's larger, there's more opportunity for newer folks to get their foot in the door there, just because you can come in at an entry level. And there's, at this point in time, there's 2 steps. There's a crime analyst 1 and a crime analyst 2. Many of the surrounding jurisdictions, they kind of want you to come in with experience already. And because of that, their pay structures are a little higher. So it's more so, I guess, of a rivalry of the surrounding jurisdictions will entice you to say, hey, you got a little experience now. We're happy to put a few more dollars in your pocket if you'll make the leap. I would say it's a rivalry in that sense, but not among the analysts themselves.
So you signed with the Yankees, you know, you signed a free agent contract to go get more money from next door. All right. Compare and contrast the two then.
Oh, they're very different agencies. So again, Fairfax is rather large, and I was only responsible for 1 station, 1 district. That was my little bubble that I was responsible for. In Arlington, even though the county itself is probably square mileage wise the same as the district that I was responsible for in Fairfax, it's the entire county. And to give a little context of Arlington, it is right across the river from DC, Washington, DC. It is a very urban, it has its rural pockets, but it's a primarily urban environment. It has a pretty dense population for its size. And so there's just a lot happening there. On top of just handling the entire county versus one subsection of it, I wear a lot of hats as well. Because where I'm at, there's me, one other crime analyst, and then we have a mapping analyst. And that's it for our unit. So there's a lot more juggling of several duties versus just having kind of one thing to focus on. So that keeps things interesting for sure.
So are you dealing with more burglaries, more residential issues versus what you were, the investigations that you were working on at Fairfax?
So for Fairfax, things that stayed at the station level were property crimes, and anything that was more serious of a person crime, that went up to the major crimes unit. So I never worked any of that, primarily over in Mount Vernon at Fairfax. Now that I'm at Arlington, although I would say the totality of the crimes are more property related than at Fairfax in general, I personally work way more person crimes because I am the primary criminal investigations analyst. I handle all of those crimes when they do come in, though I would say they are less frequent than they would be at Fairfax. So me personally, I deal with more, but that is not necessarily reflective of the crime itself.
Well, let's get into a case. This leads us to your analyst badge story. And for those that may be new to the show, the analyst badge story is the case or project an analyst worked on. It's their career-defining moment, if you will. For you, Sarah, yours deals with a sexual assault case.
Yes, it does. So I'll have to stay a little vague on some of the details just because this is still going through the trial process. But it's a pretty interesting case. So it occurred back almost a year ago at this point. It was in December of 2020. The facts of the case were that a girl was sleeping in her room. She rented a room in a house with a few other girls, and a stranger broke into her house and jumped on her, was not successful in trying to sexually assault her, but began to, and she screamed, and the stranger left in fear that she screamed and made some noise. We don't get many of those types of stranger cases. So this was a pretty big deal. We had our surveillance unit working on it. And a few days later, they saw a suspicious man in the area. They followed him. Patrol ended up pulling him over. He was very nervous. They got his name and his information. He leaves. There was a lot about him that was pointing to him potentially having been the original offender that had broken into the home. So they follow him the following night, and they follow him and watch him act suspiciously in a few other homes until he essentially attempts to re-break into the original home of the victim, and he is apprehended. So
he circled yes. back?
He circled back three times, if I haven't made that clear. And this was, I believe, a 5-day period of this particular home. So he's clearly a scary dude. So we recover his phone off of him. We start digging into it. It's a treasure trove. And then we see that he has a Google account. So we got a search warrant for his Google information. That's a lot of data. This guy uses his phone and his Google religiously. The detectives and the particular TAC, which is our surveillance unit officer, who was assigned to this case, this was just a lot of information for them to go through. So they had done like kind of a preliminary dive into all of this. And they're like, we can tell that he's a bad dude, but this is just overwhelming for us. So it was more like, you know, turn to, hey, Sarah, can you help us out going through all of this? So I dug into all of his information, all of his data. And from going through it, we were able to see that he was responsible for a few other burglaries in our area in the 2 weeks leading up to that attempted sex assault. And one of them was about 20 minutes prior to the sex assault. It was on the other side of the county. And what we knew about it at the time didn't make it sound related, but there was a lot of evidence in his phone that indicated that it was. So, you know, the more we dug into his phone, the more a pattern and a mindset just became very clear. His searches, what he was looking at, it became very clear that his strategy was he would pose as a girl that was looking to rent a room in the DMV, which is like the District of Columbia area. He would reach out to homes that seemed to have a lot of females renting rooms and essentially kind of case it and get a sense for it. Then he would go and physically case those homes before he would show up. So there was evidence that he did that at our victim's home and then a few other homes as well, outside of Arlington. So I put all this together for our detectives and they were like, this is great. But the way in which I kind of put it together, it was more like, hey, here's some like action items you guys should go and look into a little bit more. And I still think the amount of data and the amount of information that I was originally conveying to them was just overwhelming. And they weren't quite sure how to relay the severity of that to our prosecutors. So just based on the evidence that we had, he was originally just charged with, I believe, possession of burglarious tools. He had a burglary charge, but it didn't include attempted rape. And that was our biggest concern because there was just so much pointing to the fact that that was his goal. So when we sat down with our prosecutors and, you know, said, what do you guys need to feel like we can charge this? They said, we need motive and we need intent. So when I heard that, I was like, okay, that's the evidence that I'm looking at. That's what I am seeing. I see all of the intent and I see all of the motive, and I need to present this in a way that they can see it and a jury would be able to see it as well. So I took on the very monstrous task of going through all of the digital evidence that we had and essentially putting it in chronological order. So I made a timeline that overlaid all of his searches, all of his messages, all of the various times he looked at Zillow and Redfin for these homes, his CDRs, because we got his call detail records. And then what ended up playing like a big role was his Google location history, which for those who haven't dealt with it is really good, more precise location information. So I overlaid that for which the 2 weeks that he was very active in Arlington, and it really played down almost to the minute just how much activity we had digitally for him. And when we presented that timeline to our prosecutors, they were very terrified, rightfully so, and they were like, this guy is a predator and we absolutely can see intent here. I think we have more than enough, we can absolutely charge. So I consider that my badge story because I feel like it was that product that got them kind of over the goal line into seeing what we were dealing with. And I don't think that they were able to visualize what our data had without that. I feel pretty proud about that one and that we were able to really help keep a true predator off the streets.
It seems like you were able to tell the story, right? And I think that was a way to communicate here is you laid out the story and the connection between this guy's activities and the crimes that occurred. Now, did you visit any of the crime scenes as you were trying to think about putting together this story?
I didn't officially. I drive by many of them on the way to work. Mm-hmm. So unofficially, I did. Our one victim who was related to the attempted rape charge, that individual's house is truly on my way to work. So I did kind of pay more attention to that house as I was driving by. But I also know the layout of Arlington pretty well. I didn't need to get the visual on it that much.
I like the idea of you're taking data and working with some of the key parts of the evidence. And that might seem like a no-brainer, but I know there are times where analysts, sometimes on their own, sometimes they're just shut out from the investigation. So they don't really necessarily know exactly what's going on with the investigation.
I will say to speak on that part, and this is definitely adds to my advice to folks, it is absolutely a constant struggle to have a seat at the table, even when you've built, you know, a rapport and, you know, kind of a respect with your folks. Even with this particular case, I was not brought in at the onset. It was very much an after the fact situation where I went and I followed up with the detectives that were working it. And I had to ask them what they had. And then once I heard it, I was able to articulate what I could bring. And it, you know, it was like a brand new thing, you know, they're like, oh, you could go through that for us. So I think a lot of analysts definitely have had that similar struggle. And so I just say, don't get deterred when someone you've worked with before and you feel like they should know what you do and they don't get deterred. Continue to push, continue to insert yourself, continue to show up at their desk and say, what do you got? What do you have? Because that's how you get your seat at the table. A lot of times you're not going to get invited and you got to just keep earning it over and over, even though you feel like you shouldn't have to. It's totally worth, you know, making that extra effort of just like popping over, seeing what they have, because that's how you break in.
I think in this case, it seems to me that it might be understandable not to bring you in, because it seems like in the beginning, this wasn't really that big a deal, quote unquote, there. I mean, and then it obviously turned into, you know, a predator situation. So with your efforts, you discovered really what this guy was up to. So good work.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay, so let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about call detail records. We'll talk about VCAN, and we'll play Don't Be That Analyst. We'll take some calls. You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
This is Emmanuel James Tang, and I invite you to visit leapodcasts.com on the second and fourth Thursday of the month. Starting from 12th November, I've joined with ACIA and LEA Podcasts to present our Africa series of podcasts. We aim to bridge understanding between Africa and the rest of the analytical world. With shared thought and a common lexicon, we aim to broaden our analysts' worldviews, mitigate cognitive bias, refine analytical tradecraft, and improve investigative outcomes everywhere. Analysis improves through exchange.
Hey, this is Shauna Gibson from the Pacific Northwest. This is to all you crazy PEMCO drivers out there. Do you know what a zipper merge is? It is when you let somebody else get in front of you and then somebody comes in behind you. You really don't have to push everybody out. So may you all learn the zipper merge and may the 405 and I-5 be a little bit more pleasant to drive down. Good luck with that, all of you crazy drivers.
Welcome back. Sarah, I want to talk a little bit now about call detail records. To get your advice on them from the analyst perspective.
Sure. So I know that depending upon what kind of analysis folks are doing, they may or may not be dealing with them. But for those that are assisting with investigative units and digging into investigative analysis, call detail records are such a strong tool that it's really beneficial to have a crime analyst digging into those. So for those that do, or for those that want to get into it, I really emphasize and encourage you guys to get as much training as possible on it. Because if you are digging into those and finding relevant evidence in them, that's going to be something that's going to go to court. And if it goes to court and you're the one that found it, you'll be the one that's getting up on that stand. So you definitely want to have the training both to make sure that you know what you're talking about, but also to make sure that you have the credibility when you get up there and you have to testify. So I cannot emphasize enough, don't start digging into these until you have some training under your belt, just to make sure that you're good to go with these. For those who have never dealt with them before, they are the records from phone carriers for, you know, the interactions that a phone has with the network, with other phones, and they are not made for law enforcement. They are engineering records that they are by law required to give to us when we give them search warrants. So they can be very complicated, and there's a lot of caveats to them a lot of times. And, you know, as technology changes, and now that we get into the 5G arena, they just continue to get more complex. So I definitely encourage not only training to dive into them, but just ongoing training to just make sure that you're understanding the changes to these records. I like to call them snowflakes, because every record return that I have gotten has been different than the one before it. So it's just really crucial to be up to date on the changes in the field.
And most of this data is coming back to you electronically. Is this in some kind of spreadsheet format?
Yeah. So they'll typically come back usually in a zip file. Also, if another word to the wise, if a detective or whoever asks for them sends you an email and says, hey, can you just download this for me? Tell them they have to go do it themselves, because there's a lot of times you'll get sent an email or something that has it's a password that's connected just to their emails. So to prevent the back and forth, yeah, just make sure that they send you the records themselves. But they are, yeah, they'll be in an electronic format. They'll be in Excel spreadsheets, or AT&T will give it to you in a text file format. But they're all things for the analyst arena.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And please explain why you're telling them to go do it themselves. You know, you might want to not just leave it at, hey, go do that yourself.
Yeah. For chain of custody purposes, you want to make sure like the detective or whoever it is that's getting these records, you know, they have it all squared away. They have their original copy of it, because they will need that for court. So let them save it, have their own copy for their records. Then have them give you a copy of it, and then you can have your working copy. Again, it's really beneficial to have an analyst go through these records, not only because we typically have a little more time to dedicate to them than a detective would, but we're going to think of things to go through that a detective probably wouldn't. A detective might just go in there and say, hey, was my bad guy at this burglary when this burglary happened? And then they're content and they move along. Whereas when an analyst gets those records, they're going to say, okay, well, he was at this burglary when it happened, but it looks like he was calling this co-conspirator that we think he's had. Oh, look at this. He doesn't live anywhere close to this burglary. And this is the only time that he's gone over there. So we can bring in some more hard-hitting facts about the call detail records that really can enrich the evidence and pack a harder punch.
What's the turnaround time these days when you put in a subpoena to these telephone companies to get this data back?
Well, nowadays they do require search warrants. It has now been whittled down to the big three. T-Mobile and Sprint merged last year. So it's just T-Mobile, AT&T, and Verizon. It varies on who you're sending your legal process to. Typically, Verizon and AT&T are easier to work with, and their turnaround is pretty good. T-Mobile, those who work with these records are probably laughing right now. They can be a little slow. I would say recently they've been pretty good. It's been maybe a week or two, and that's not bad for them. Verizon and AT&T, they'll get it to you in a few days, so the turnaround is usually pretty quick. But T-Mobile, you might not want to hold your breath.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I mean, I'm showing my age here, but I've talked on the show a couple of times now of when I was doing telephone toll analysis in the early 2000s about getting in a scanned in PDF, trying to get translated into spreadsheets and dealing with that and the turnaround times. And these cell phone companies were totally unprepared for the requests that law enforcement sent them. So they really were overwhelmed. And it would be interesting now to see what their process is, because I'm sure it's so streamlined. It's just a matter of really pulling the data, getting it out and sent to you. It's probably a nice packaged process now where they're dealing with these all the time, because they got to be dealing with thousands upon thousands of requests.
Oh, yeah. They definitely have their own units within these companies now that deal specifically with this stuff. And, you know, they, I believe they call themselves like legal compliance specialists, and they have people, they're totally dedicated solely to responding to these requests. Cause you're right. I mean, everybody has a cell phone these days and law enforcement knows it. So that we're definitely hitting them up for these records.
For most people that I've talked to, when they have had to testify in court based on their records, it's rare that I've heard someone really get challenged by the defense. I don't know if your dad gave you any pointers or anything like that, but
yeah, so I've testified a handful of times. Defense, it really depends on how knowledgeable defense is. And of course, the circumstances of your case and how consequential the call detail records are. I've come to find that they tend to be a little too technical for defense. So they don't quite know how to question you on things, but it depends. I mean, as long as you go in there and you really know your stuff, and most importantly, you know what you can and cannot speak to, you'll be fine. No matter what they kind of, you know, they try to trip you up on, as long as you know what training and experience has taught you and you know the limits of what you can assert, you'll be totally fine.
All right. Well, let's move on now to VCAN, because you're current president.
And I am.
For those that aren't familiar with VCAN, what's the jurisdiction for VCAN?
So VCAN is the Virginia Crime Analysis Network. We are a nonprofit, the regional association for Virginia, that brings training and resources to not only primarily, you know, law enforcement analysts, but also detectives or even students that are studying law enforcement related fields that just want to have the resources and networking within Virginia. Unfortunately, our bylaws are strict in the sense that we can't allow membership for anyone who doesn't have jurisdiction or is not attending school in Virginia. But we still, even with those limitations, have over 200 members. So we're a pretty solid organization.
So if you decide to move across the state line to Maryland, you would have to step down as president.
I would, and I would be very heartbroken about it.
Are you a mini association in that you're obviously holding elections, you're holding training, you're meeting on a regular basis?
Yeah, we're like a baby IACA. We have a board. So it's, you know, myself, Jennifer Satterway is our vice president. And for those who have seen our amazing memes on our social media and on the forums, all credit goes to her. She is our meme queen. Amanda Caligiuri is our treasurer. She's wonderful. And Mary Beth Anderzak is our secretary, who is maintaining all of our social media as well. So we have an amazing board, well-oiled machine. We're very blessed in that regard. And yeah, we have monthly webinars that are across the board. Either they're case studies or they are trainings on specific topics that we've been very lucky in the past few years to be able to offer not only to VCAN, but to IACA members as well. And then we also have a biannual symposium, which is an in-person training. It'll be a one-day training. We have it once in the fall in October, and then once in the spring. That'll usually be March or April, where we'll have a full day in-person training with various different speakers.
So as president, what are your goals? What are you hoping to accomplish in the next couple of years?
I definitely want to continue to just bring really great quality presenters to Virginia. Now that we are immersing out of the pandemic, which is, you know, really thrown a wrench in what we can bring to our members. I'm really excited to have more in-person trainings again. We would love to have like a full week in-person training for maybe like a particular topic like Excel or something like that. That's a really specialized thing. Whatever we can do to just really give our members more training opportunities, especially now that a lot of agencies aren't sending folks far. If we can keep things in-house and just give them more access to things, that would really make me proud and make me happy that we're bringing our membership what we're promising them.
Well, speaking of presenting, so you were one of the keynote speakers in the 2018 IACA conference.
I was, yep.
And so let's talk about that a little bit, because that's can be a little nerve-wracking. The keynote speaker is obviously quite an honor, and you are speaking in front of 300-ish of your fellow analysts. So take us through that, just the prepping and how you felt going in, how it was, and what you felt like coming out of it.
Yeah, so it's funny. I had had this particular case study back from my Fairfax days that I thought was a pretty good one to turn into a presentation. And I submitted it for the IACA conference in California, Newport Beach. When I had submitted it for consideration, they wrote me back and asked if I would be okay with it being considered for the keynote spot. And I was like, sure, why not? Thinking I was in no way a contender for that kind of status. And they wrote me back when they had made their decisions and said, we would love to have your presentation be one of the two case studies that we have during our keynote slot. Would you still be interested? And after a moment of slight freak out, I was very honored and said, of course, I would love that. I had not presented yet. That was really my first one. So that was truly diving straight into the deep end. But I was really excited about it. And I believe that had a pretty high attendance rate, that conference. So I was a little nervous about that. But
you thank Disneyland for that, right?
Yeah. It was a great location. It had an amazing lineup. Just that entire conference had amazing presentations. So I was second of the two presentations, which I think was good because it helped me kind of sit and chill out beforehand. I am thankful that I don't get terribly nervous doing presentations. I'm not one of those folks that needs to get up there and picture anybody in their underwear or anything like that. So once I got started, it was pretty seamless, and IACA members are wonderful and very engaged, and I had a lot of like thoughtful questions afterwards. So I was very fortunate. It went very well, and it was a great experience.
Yeah, and I take credit for that, because I was the one harping for years that it should be analysts up there presenting it as a keynote and not bringing in somebody that happened to work with an analyst talking about it. Yeah, that's what I mean by, I take credit for it.
No,
that was awfully pompous of me to say it the way I did.
No, I appreciate you because, one, I appreciate you because that led to my opportunity. But two, I completely agree. I mean, we learn best from each other, and learning what, strategies that other analysts take to, their tasks. And that's how we learn. So it's definitely so beneficial to have analysts being the ones that are in that slot.
Yeah. And then this past year in Vegas, I can't remember the guy's name, but he basically came out and said, I'm not the analyst that worked on this, but I'm here to present. I mean, that was basically what he said. And I wanted to throw a tomato at him. Like, what are we doing? Why are we back to this, people talking about analysis instead of what they did, he or she did?
We've regressed.
Yes. But anyway, well, that's good stuff. That's exciting stuff for so early in your career to be able to be the keynote speaker in that. So
yes, that was awesome. Very exciting. Yeah.
And nervous great too. Oof.
It was, but it was a great experience. I was very fortunate that I didn't have any technical difficulties or like anything outside of my control that would have really thrown me off. So it was very fortunate. It was a wonderful experience, and it made me excited to do more presentations. So
yeah, well, geez, yes. We're talking about the conference and you're talking about technical difficulty. I had one of the all-time gaffes presenting at one of the conferences. I was doing a wrap-up video that I had done. It was Friday during closing ceremonies, and I was doing this montage video played to music and all the different pitches that were played throughout the week. And oh my goodness, it was one bad decision after another. They told me to get up early to set up, so I did it, but then it looked like I was interrupting the person that was speaking, and then Then my laptop ran out of battery in the middle of the presentation, so it quit working.
Oh, no.
And somebody IM'd me in the middle of the presentation. Oh, it was basically how not to do a presentation.
Oh,
so
no.
It was so super embarrassing there that so many things went wrong. And I was like, oh, man. I can laugh about it now, but at least you didn't have that experience.
Yeah, the sting has gone. But sometimes those are... they're not good, but in the sense that you're like, okay, I survived that.
Well, yeah. So. Yeah, I'd rather do it.
End.
Yeah, I'd rather do it there than like at trial where, you know, it's more serious outcome of making a mistake. But
yeah.
All right. So we have some callers on the line. We're going to play Don't Be That Analyst. I guess before we do you have a Don't Be That Analyst?
Ooh, I would say don't be that analyst that responds to a lengthy request completed within an hour and says, sorry for the delay, because you are setting up a expectation that we have a magic button that we do not. So please do not be that analyst that is quick to the response and set yourself and your colleagues up for unrealistic expectations.
That's good advice. All right. So our first caller is Brian. Brian, what's your don't be that analyst?
Don't be the analyst who uses phrases like reimagine and circle back.
Circle back. We were just talking about circle back, right?
Yeah.
So that is a little bit of jargon, right?
And oh, yeah.
One of the things that in my office we joke around about, and we downloaded this top 10 office jargon. And it's funny when it comes into play. One of the jargon was when you're in a meeting, if you want to sound smart and there's someone doing a presentation, you interrupt them and say, hey, actually, could you go back to that last slide? And then say, oh, yep. Okay, good. Continue. And you don't even really need anything, but the fact that you do that, you command the room and make yourself sound important. And
right.
Like a week later, we were all in a meeting and that happened. And we questioned whether the guy was legit or was just doing that to sound important.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely a great way to seem like you're taking some seriously diligent notes there, whether or not you actually are.
Yeah. But I don't know. Yeah, we did that don't be that ass. We were talking about circling back.
Yeah. Also, if I'm asking you to circle back, it's probably over email and it's probably because you didn't answer something that I needed you to. So let's not use circle back or do anything to elicit an actual need for circle back. Let's try to like avoid that altogether.
Yeah, respond the first time, right?
Yeah.
All right. Next on the line is Eric. Eric, what's your don't be that analyst?
Don't be that analyst who's condescending to your research partners. Be nice to the academics.
He is obviously talking from his camp, right? The researchers. But it is interesting with analysis and academics. This, I don't know if I would call it a love-hate relationship, but it's not as smooth as it should be.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't think it's love-hate either, but there's definitely a sometimes like an us and them mentality when it shouldn't be that. We're all here to accomplish the same goal and further the field. So we're all team at the end of the day.
And I really do think part of the struggle is telling the story. Explaining what needs to be done and how it needs to be done, meaning the research gives us the idea or the best practice, but then getting it into police department and explaining what the research is telling them, I swear is half the battle.
Oh, for sure. I mean, research, that's what's like informing the profession on what best practices and different solutions are, but oh, people don't like change.
All right. Next on the line is Jim. Jim, what's your don't be that analyst?
Don't be that analyst who says, oh, you want me to look into that residential burglary spike over in the Larceny Heights neighborhood? Sure thing. 30 minutes later, hey, Sarge, here's a printout of every residential burglary in Larceny Heights over the last 2 years. I know it's a long report, but that's because I went the extra mile and included some burglaries from the adjacent neighborhoods too. Then 2 weeks later, Geez, I feel so underappreciated. I just don't get it. Why doesn't anyone listen to me? I do so much and they never seem to take me seriously. Don't be that analyst.
Oh, man. Do not be that analyst! Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point.
Yeah, I think it's definitely tempting in the beginning. And this gets me back to what I was saying before, where you really have to know and understand the case or the reason why they're asking for it in the first place, right?
For sure.
And so if they are looking for that, there's certainly asking you to do that. There's certainly a reason for it. There's something that they're after. And you need to know that. You need to know the scope of what it is, because technically the analyst didn't do anything wrong. If he was asking for the list of burglaries, that's what he gave them. But certainly, as you have already mentioned too, there's so much more that you can do.
Yeah, for sure. And you got to know where to expend your energy. And if you are just throwing all of yourself and all of your resources into every single thing, on top of being completely burned out, you're just not going to have enough hours in the day. So you're gonna think people are seeing what you're doing, but really a lot of times they don't understand how much time and attention you give to certain stuff. So you just gotta definitely dig into things and definitely don't stop at just what is asked, but certainly know what's worthy of your energy and what isn't.
Good. And next on the line is Danielle. Danielle, what is your don't be that analyst?
Don't be the analyst that just does the bare minimum. When somebody asks you for something, dig deep, and you will find that you can provide them with so much more information. Don't be literal. Just really expand your knowledge when you're looking for something. So don't be that analyst that does the bare minimum.
It's like she just heard our conversation.
Danielle is my spirit person. Oh my goodness. She hit the nail right on the head. She's so right. A lot of times, and I don't know if anyone else has experienced this, but there's sometimes where you find something and you get really excited about it and you go and you show your detective or whoever you're working with, and they're like, and you just see the like excitement in their eyes, and they just think that you gave them something magical. Like, that all comes from not doing the bare minimum and digging into something. So totally preach, Danielle, you got it.
And the last one is Joan. Joan, what is your don't be that analyst?
Hey, Jason, what I would suggest is don't be that analyst that goes into another analyst database and changes their original queries without telling them.
Oh, that's fighting actions right there.
Oh, yeah. That's like such a big analyst pet peeve.
it reminds me the one time I had a coworker and his heart was in the right place, but he went through our network folders and changed the names of them because he didn't like the names of the folders, which if somebody that's not technical might not think that's big a deal, but when you have links and connections and all that stuff going through all those folders, you just broke all those links by changing the names.
Oof.
And that was
yeah,
a little bit frustrating. So I can imagine about changing queries or changing stuff that you don't let the rest of the team know that you changed.
Yeah, you never know what you unintentionally broke and added work on to somebody else for.
Yeah, but it goes back to understanding the full scope of things, right? And
yeah,
it happens with new analysts. You're not thinking that what you're doing will make an impact. And certainly once you get in there and experience data and police departments and all the ins and outs of the job, you find out this stuff that everything's connected, right?
Yes. Yes. You start to realize that there are unintended consequences sometimes when you dig into some things. So yeah, sometimes that's unfortunately a trial and error thing you learn.
So that's don't be that analyst. And if you have the don't be that analyst and you want to be on the show, you can always contact us at leapodcasts@gmail.com. Finishing up then, Sarah, let's talk about personal interests. You seek out with a couple of your friends new coffee shops and podcasts. So tell me a little bit about how that works.
Yeah. So myself and a few coworkers of mine, we have a little weekly tradition where we, it's every Tuesday morning, we will venture on over to a new coffee shop in Arlington, which there's always a new one. We have yet to run out of options. We've actually just gotten to the point that we can no longer walk to a new one. Like that's how many we've had. And we've been doing this for, oh my goodness, probably 7 or 8 months. So we'll go and get a new coffee. And then we will also, we like to listen to a crime podcast. So we'll have like our crime podcast that we'll discuss as we go and get our new coffee. And it is the best weekly tradition ever.
Very good. Well, I hope this podcast made it at one of the weeks.
we have a very lengthy list, so it is on the list.
So what is your go-to coffee drink?
Oh, I am a cold brew fan.
Okay.
So it does not matter that it is getting cold out nowadays. Like that's a year-round constant order for me. Big fan.
I like them as well. The annoying part about it is they put so much ice in there that the actual liquid that you get is half the container.
That's a fair criticism. Yeah.
Yeah.
You run out of your drink much faster.
Yeah. I think the one time I asked at Dunkin' Donuts if they could do it without ice, and they they looked at me strange, like, you want to do what? Like, well, it'd be a lot more if you didn't have any ice in there.
They were on to you. That's why they gave you that look.
Yeah. They're like, oh, it's an iced coffee. You realize by definition, it's iced coffee, right? That's by definition, right? The other personal interest that you have, your binge watch TV shows. And so I was just telling you in the prep call that I recently watched the first two seasons of Breaking Bad. And
the best.
It was interesting for me because I am not necessarily a rerun person. So I don't normally watch movies over and over and over again, with the only exception is Christmas movies. But I don't normally watch the same movie over and over and over again. And I don't normally watch shows on syndication. But it was fascinating now to go back and watch, now that I know the end, and with Breaking Bad, and I've even started watching Better Call Saul. It was interesting to go back to watch the first two seasons of Breaking Bad.
Do you think you'll finish it out? Like, has it hooked you enough that you'll watch it to the end?
No, I think I'm done, actually. I think I got a little, at least taste. I had a gap in my shows, I think. It was back in August. And now I got a couple other shows that have been coming out and whatnot. So I'm not sure. Yeah. I think I got a little bit of my fill.
And there's a lot of content out there. I understand that struggle.
Yeah. It's funny. I really found, what's the wife's name? The wife I found totally annoying. Skylar. I don't remember the first time watching it, her being so annoying, but this second time around, oh my goodness, she came off as so annoying to me.
Yeah, she's certainly, I wouldn't say she's the reason that I would watch, but oh my goodness. I am a sucker for a show that has not only good character development, but like every character is not wholly good or bad. They're very complex and they make you feel complicated emotions about them. Ugh, all about those shows, which is Breaking Bad through and through.
Yes. Yeah. So what do you have, a show that you're watching now that you're into?
I do. My flavor of the week right now is Good Girls, which I don't think they're going to have a new season of it. It's on Netflix. I believe NBC is where it's originally airing, but it's actually, funny enough, it's almost like a female version of Breaking Bad, but in a funnier, more comedic tone. It's very good. So if anybody kind of wants something along those lines, yeah. Netflix is waiting for you.
I do find it, if I find out an older show only had one season and they're not coming back, I almost don't even bother. Right?
Yeah.
And
because why invest?
Yeah, because I think it's Dragonfly, the guy that created Game of Thrones. He had a series and it only lasted one season. And it does look good to me, but it lasted one season. So I know it's going to be incomplete. So I'm not even going to bother. I find myself watching all these post-apocalyptic shows. I like The Walking Dead, and they're all the same formula, right? The whole world goes apart, and then you have like three groups that are going through this new wilderness of society, and they all meet up after a season or two.
Yes. So did you like Lost? Because Lost, it's not necessarily post-apocalyptic, but kind of has that formula.
Yes, I was very much into Lost, and I did like Lost. I didn't like how Lost ended.
Same.
But I did really like Lost. Well, that also reminds me, I really like The Sopranos, even though I don't like the way Sopranos ended.
Yeah, and there's very few shows that of that caliber that can carry it to that last episode. Like, it's just stakes are too high.
This seems to get it right. But anyway, well, very good. Well, geez, I could sit here and talk TV and TV shows with you all afternoon. But our last question to the show is Words to the World. And this is where I give the guest the last word. Sarah, what are your words to the world?
My words to the world would be, analysts out there, don't forget why it is that you do this. I think a lot of us in the past year and a half have just been really emotionally burnt out from the state of the world, the state of the profession, just kind of where we are, the particular struggles of being, you know, sworn versus civilian or whatever it is in your particular area that's getting you down. Don't forget why you do this. This is such a purpose-driven job that we really make a difference in. And it's remembering that purpose that makes you the analyst who you are. So to just don't let it get you down and don't lose sight of that.
Well, I leave every guest with you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. But I do appreciate you being on the show, Sarah. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Thanks, Jason. You too.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcasts.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Alder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.